And last time we really started talking about the why, the purpose of the mechitza. And that makes a lot of sense because when you're talking about a physical structure, a great question to ask before you think about how it should be built is what you're building it for. Even, I don't know if any of you has ever even renovated a kitchen, right? The before you start drawing up the blueprint, blueprints. Before you start drawing up, I'm losing my English here in Israel. Sorry. Before you start drawing up the blueprints of how it should be designed, right? You have to think about, well, what are really my priorities in constructing this? And of course, there's some things that are not completely under your control. Like if there's a supporting wall over here, it's going to be kind of hard for you to move it 2 feet just because you'd like a wider refrigerator. But on some basic level with construction, the well done construction is construction where the form is going to follow the function, and as well as being aesthetically pleasing. And the function is going to be defined by someone's purpose and what they're doing. So last week we started talking about the purpose of mechitza. We saw together we talked about a couple of issues. We're going to fill that in now because we didn't really complete our discussion. And tonight, or today for most of you, today what we're going to be talking about is more about the kind of the what and the how, how the mechitza is structured and how that follows from the questions about its purpose. And when we think about when we talked about the why, kind of the prompting question to start the night was, why did this become the hallmark of the Orthodox synagogue? We discussed that a little bit, though it's still a remarkable thing that it happened to the extent that it happened. When we're talking about the what, I want you to just think for a minute about what it means, men and women, though I think for men it's experienced very differently, what it means to kind of enter into the synagogue space and enter into the Ezrat Nashim. What is the feeling? Is the feeling, Ezrat Nashim can be built in a lot of different ways. Women's section, right, can be constructed. It can be constructed above. It can be constructed on the same level. It can be side by side. It can be on the back. Lincoln Square Synagogue, Rabbi Jay was talking about, is almost built in the round, which is fairly creative. So there's a lot of different ways in which they can be constructed. But what is the feeling of entering into that space, into that structure? In other words, there's an effect on prayer. So we talked last time about sort of the spiritual effect on prayer of separation. But there's this additional effect on prayer of how the separation is structured. I'll just throw in an interesting quip. In my local shul, I was on the VOD for, I might actually still be on the VOD and have forgotten, but I've been on the shul's committee and we had a meeting. And one of the issues in the meeting was that another female member of the VOD wanted to see some changes made in the structure of the women's section. There's a balcony in the shul, and she wanted to see the front of the balcony handled differently from how it's currently handled. In order to make her case, she invited the rest of the VOD, of which everyone was a man except for me and her. So she invited everybody to go upstairs to sit in the women's section and see what she was talking about. And the men were shocked. It was absolutely fascinating. The men were completely shocked. They couldn't get over it. What? You daven like this? You really can't see anything when you're sitting down? It was amazing to me to see how things that I take for granted as sort of like a baseline when I go into shul, and they hadn't even been considered. And these are people who, like I said, are congregational leaders. It's not that they specifically have an axe to grind in any particular direction. It's just when she pointed out to them that there were certain places where you could sit and there was nowhere to put your legs because of how the angle of the wall had been constructed, and there was actually nowhere for a woman to put a sitter because of how the aisles were, the men just couldn't believe it. And part of why I couldn't believe it is because that, whereas I think for women in synagogue, where a lot of the ritual, public ritual action is happening where the men are, so that if there are sight lines, the woman is pretty keenly aware of what that looks like. And it can be part of her shul experience, at least if she wants it to be, in many cases. for men, very frequently, it doesn't register. It's not really, and perhaps, and that's another thing that we should talk about a little bit tonight, is that rightly so. There are some halachic authorities that would say it's rightly so that they had never had that point of imagination. But on the other hand, there's really, there was something very, very important in that moment. And so actually I want to suggest for the men and the women here, I want to suggest if you ever have a chance right now during COVID might not be the easiest time, but if you ever have a chance, not during services, to walk into your synagogue, say a pasuk or a little tefillah, so you're respecting the space. But if you ever have a chance to walk into your synagogue, not during the time of tefillah, and walk into the other gender's space, it can be very interesting. It can be very interesting in terms of how you understand your own perspective. All right, let's get into some sources and start seeing how this sort of thing can play out. Let's hope my share screen is successful. I know you're all rooting for me. Let's go. Yes, it worked. It's so nice when it works. Okay. I want to start by talking again about the purposes of the mechitza. And last time, the things that we kept seeing coming up in the Gemaras that we were looking at, and even in a Rambam that we saw, was a concern. The Yerushalmi was concern about mixing, right? There was a big concern about kalut rosh, frivolity. Prayer is something that's supposed to take place within a context of kovod rosh, of seriousness. Even when there's joy, it's supposed to be gilu birada, to rejoice with the sense of trembling. We're very, very happy to be before God, but we're also aware that we're before God. We're not just hanging out. And that was really a focus of what we saw. And we started talking about gazing. And one of the things we talked about when we started to talk about gazing was the question of reciprocity. Remember reciprocity. We talked about how frivolity could be of concern both for men and for women. Right? If we're worried about mixing together leading to frivolous behavior, that's not something that one gender we're worried about and the other gender we're not. We're worried about anybody involved in that. We talked about how gazing, looking, could also potentially have aspects of reciprocity, right? There's the kind of looking where it's, wink, wink, signaling each other, what have you. There could be a whole level of frivolous communication that could be built through looking. But there's some other possibilities, and that would be reciprocal. But there's also the possibility that there's a particular concern about men looking at women. And that's, for example, we saw this in the Perusha Mishnayot of Rambam. And the Perusha Mishnayot of Rambam was particularly interesting for us because in the Mishnah Torah, which is the more halachically authoritative work, Rambam has said that we need the separation in synagogue because we're worried about mingling. And here in his Perusha Mishnayot, Rambam says, Makom anashim lamala makom anashim. Here he's talking about Simcha Peira Shueva, that the women were above, gavua mimenu, higher than it, kedei shelo yistaklu ha'anashim v'nashim, so that the men not look at the women. So Rambam is saying that the concern with gazing is not reciprocal. The concern with gazing is particularly for men to look at women. Even so, if you look at Igrot Moshe, explains that he's not concerned here about, according to Igrot Moshe, Rambam's concern here is not about men looking at women per se. According to Igrot Moshe, here's what he means. Shekavanatav ha'perusho l'sukah. What he means in the Perusha Mishnayot, Rambam, that is lehistaklut kazot shechola la'avi lidei kalut rosh. Rambam is referring to a type of looking which could lead to frivolity. Okay. The avim nistapek bekavanato b'perusho, and even if we're not certain about what his Rambam's intention is in his commentary to the Mishnah, in lanu ela mashikatav Rambam be'ilchotav, the Mishnah Torah is more authoritative. So the Igrot Moshe is already setting out a claim that his understanding of the Rambam, and it's going to be consistent with his understanding of the purpose of the Mechitza per se, is that looking might be a factor, but the real concern is mingling. The fact of mere looking isn't the concern. But you know, there are other ways to interpret this Rambam. And what causes a complication is a different halacha of the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah. Here, this is not talking specifically about shul at all. It's talking about someone who acts in a certain kind of way, who would be acting in a way that would lead them to be a suspect for violating norms of licit sexual behavior. So, asur le'adam likrotz biyadav uvraglav o lirmoz be'einav l'achat min arayot. A man cannot make signals with his hands, his legs, or to hint with his eyes. We're back to winking to a woman who is prohibited to him. And then amistakel afilu be'etzpa ketana shel isha v'nitkaven le'anot. A man who deliberately looks even at a woman's smaller finger, but his intention is deliberately sexual, i.e., he is deliberately sexually objectifying what he sees. A man in that case is doing something, according to the Rambam, that's prohibited. So you can readily see how there might be an inclination to link these halachot together. Now, these halachot are not intrinsically linked necessarily. This discussion of the Rambam is when he's talking, it's in Hilchot Yetzirei Bia. It's when he's talking about the laws of what's proper or improper sexual behavior. The halacha about mechitza, where he talks about mingling, is when he's talking about Sukkos and the Simchat Beis HaShoeva and Sukkos, because as we discussed extensively last time, unfortunately, we don't have a siman in Shulchan Aruch. We don't have a section of halachas of the Rambam that are devoted to mechitza in Shul. Just not there. Okay? So Simchat Beis HaShoeva becomes the place to look. So we could connect this to the mechitza, especially in light of the fact that in the Perusha Mishnayot, in his commentary to the Mishnah, Rambam connects looking to the idea of the separation at Simchat Beis HaShoeva, but we don't have to. And this becomes a debate between halachic authorities. We already saw Rav Moshe Feinstein who says, that's not what the Rambam means. The Rambam really is not focused on looking as being the reason why we have a mechitza. And the Sri Deish agrees with that. And here's, of all people, the person who's the major interlocutor with Rav Moshe Feinstein in issues of mechitza, its purpose and construction, is Rav Yoel Teitelbaum of Satmar, the Satmar Rebbe. So the Satmar Rebbe reads things very differently. Shehaya hachashash rak bishvil hahistaklut. No, the concern, he says, was looking. She'al pi rov e efshar lashgiach al zeh, because it's not something you can control. Mingling is something that can be controlled. It's something that even other people around can deter people from mingling during davening. But looking is a harder thing to get a handle on. And how are you going to know if the intention of the looking was inappropriate? Remember the Rambam that we saw. Not the one on Mechitza. The Rambam that we saw about appropriate sexual behavior talked about a problem with a man looking at a woman with deliberate intent to derive sexual pleasure from that act. And Raviola is saying, well, how on earth are we going to know if we see a man looking at a woman in the women's section, if he's doing it with an intent or not with an intent? How can we get a grip on this? Sof kol sof hirgishu, he says, at the end of the day, the sages in Simchas Beis HaShoeva felt shaita bein ka'am histaklut v'ra'orei avera v'zeh nikra kalut rosh, that there was amongst the nation, amongst the people, looking and sexual fantasizing, and that's what they meant when they talk about kalut rosh. So on one side here, we've got Rav Moshe Feinstein who's saying the essential thing that we're concerned about with gender separation is mingling, which can lead to kalut rosh. And here we've got Rav Yoel Teitelbaum saying, nope, kalut rosh, the thing we're most concerned about that can lead to kalut rosh, and which is an issue per se for him, is looking. You can already, I think, start to think how that would influence how one might construct a mechitza, right? A mechitza, according to a posek, who is prioritizing physical separation so that there cannot be mingling, might, for example, be a balcony with nothing in front of it. because the height differential and distance, while it allows for clear sight lines, will not allow the men and women to interact. Whereas, if a halachic authority is particularly concerned about seeing, and specifically men seeing women, then they might prioritize, let's say, a high curtain in the shul, even if the curtain is flimsy and the men and women are only inches away from each other. Even if you just think for a moment, again, I just think it's helpful in these kinds of cases to think about our own experiences. Think for a moment about where you daven, assuming it has a women's section, and think about how that women's section is structured, and consider what you think is the kind of halachic priority that was taken and how that mechitza was designed. Is the mechitza in your shul one that seems to be more oriented towards preventing men and women from mingling? Or is the mechitza in your shul one that seems to be more oriented towards preventing looking, or perhaps according to some of these authorities, specifically preventing men from looking at women? Okay. Two more points before we really get very much, much deeper into the question of structure. Point number one, well, what about women looking at men? Is that an issue or not? So actually, Shevet Alevi, Shmuel Alevi Vosner, who is a very important Hasidic posek, writes about this a little bit. He says as follows, "En lahachish, one cannot deny, she'im be'emet mistaklim l'shem znut v'ishut, ovrim anashim kemo hanashim." You can't deny that if women really are looking at men with deliberate sexual intent, that's also an issur for women. It's also prohibited for women. "De'lo tatur achrei levavchem v'achrei nechem," the pasuk in Shema, which says one should not stray after one's heart and eyes, "who love is a mitzvah lo taseh," a prohibition, "hashaveh b'chol, b'chol," which is equal for everyone, all Jews, "shemitzuvin anashim ala lavin kamo anashim," because women are obligated in prohibitions like men are. "Aval," but he says, "lirot stam v'yabitu banashim b'li lazun enehem," if women just happen to see the men and they're looking at them without deliberately trying to feast their eyes, "dainu b'li machshava shel ishut," without sexual thinking, as is typically the case when women see men from the women's section, okay, our sages were not worried about it. So what's interesting to me about this tshuva is, first of all, that the question gets raised and taken seriously, because often in rabbinic literature, it's assumed that the person who's going to have active sexual desire is a man and not specifically a woman. Or that would be more of a concern, at least halachically. So it's interesting the question is getting raised. The issue is getting addressed very seriously in this question. And the response is effectively, it's theoretically possible, but it's just not something that we're going to worry about. Okay. Next issue that I just want to raise is there's also a more extreme view that goes beyond just talking about looking. And this is a view that we find in the Chatam Sofer. The Chatam Sofer is actually not talking originally about mechitza. The broader context of this tshuva, which becomes a very important tshuva with regard to the issue of kol isha, is whether a shul can form a sort of choir for a ceremony involving a non-Jewish dignitary. And that choir might involve women participating. But along the way, he says something very strong. Ki anu maminim. For we believe, he says, "Shekot tefila o shevach b'da'ash mitarev b'machshava hahi shum hirhur," that any prayer or praise or expression of gratitude where into this thought is intermixed any sexual fantasizing whatsoever, afilu b'ishto, even if it's the man thinking about his wife sexually, lo ta'ale b'malot b'fnei Hashem yiparach, that prayer doesn't go up. It's a very, very strong statement. Okay, it's particularly strong because I think sometimes the times when it's most challenging for people to control their thinking is when they're trying to consciously do it. He's saying here that if someone has sexual thought intermingled with the prayer is nothing. The lo tikubal lefanav, it won't be received before him. And then he says something really striking. Umipnei ze anu mafrishim anashim min ha'anashim bevet ha'kneset bipnei atzman. Shelo yaveu yavo lidei hirhur b'shat tefila. V'tiyet tefila nidchet rachmana litzlan. And that's why we separate men and women in the shul, so that fantasizing of the sort not get mixed in with tefila, and God forbid the tefila not be rejected. So again, we had the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah talking about mingling, which really follows what we saw in the Talmud. We saw the Rambam in the Perush HaMishnayot talk about looking, and it was hard to get a handle on exactly the nature of his looking concern. Was it reciprocal or not? We had Rav Moshe Feinstein say the concern is mingling, and the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah is authoritative. And then we had Rav Yoel Teitelbaum saying, no, the chief concern is looking. And the concern about looking ties into the halachas of men not being able to look specifically at women with sexual intent. And it's just that how on earth are we going to police what's sexual intent and what's not? We just have to cut off the sight lines, as it were, entirely. And here we have the Chasam Sofer saying something even more extreme. And he's effectively saying, if men, he's saying the entire purpose of separation is this. And the purpose is not looking, because if men were to look and there were to be a sexual intent, the prayer is gone. So it's very, very, very strong. It raises a whole other set also of questions that are not addressed that directly in the post-game. There's some oblique references, which really gets to this question of like, you know, so to what extent, even if within the picture of gender separation in the synagogue, to what extent are we supposed to be aware of each other? So, for example, like what we just saw in the name of the Shevet Alevi about women looking at men, he takes it for granted that women are aware of the men in the shul, and that that's not something we're too worried about. And by the way, that makes sense, right? Because what's going to be the point of the woman going specifically to pray in the Ezrat Nashim if she has no awareness of the shul being a place where prayer is taking place? It could still have a point. There's a value for prayer to take place in a shul. There is a value for prayer to take place at the same time when the community davens. But one of the motivators for many women going to shul is to be able to follow the service. And following the service inherently for a woman entails being aware of men who are there. What's really interesting to me here about the Chatam Sofer, and why I think it goes farther than Rav Yoel, is he's not just saying that he's worried about the men looking. He's really saying that what it's all about is keeping the men away from thinking about the women. Which seems to suggest that he almost doesn't want there to be awareness at all. Now, some of that might work reasonably well with, let's say, some of the ideas we saw in Rav Soloveitchik last week. If prayer is ultimately a personal meeting with the Kaddish Baruch Hu, and it's not a social occasion, it's not a family occasion, existentially, it's me and God, even though there's a tzibur around me, I'm situated in the tzibur, but it's all about me and God. So, okay, Seder, fine. But if we think about prayer as something that can be affected sometimes by this awareness, then we might have a problem. What do I mean? There are little ways in which it can be very important for men to have some awareness that women are there. Let's say, men talking right next to the mechitza, which in my experience, unfortunately, happens with some frequency, right? So if the men are really aware that there are women davening there and they understand what that means, they're going to be less likely to do that. And that's good, because it will help women to be able to daven. In some synagogues, women recite Birkat HaGomel, dafka with a minyan, and sometimes during the time when the Torah is out. It's hard to do that or to facilitate something like that. In some synagogues, women share the name of a sick person. There are different scenarios with Kaddish in different synagogues. There's the question of, is the Shaliach Tzibur or is the Baal Kori in the synagogue taking care that their voice is loud enough that everyone seated in every place of the synagogue, including the Ezra's Nashim, would have the ability to hear it. So there's a compelling aspect to what the Chatam Sofer is saying, which is that he wants to try to make sure that the men are as focused on tefillah as possible and not taking the thoughts in an incorrect direction. And he sees separation in the synagogue is a great way to facilitate that, which is different from the initial message about let's prevent frivolity between men and women. And at the same time, if we really took this idea to the logical extreme, it might sometimes do a disservice to the community as a whole, or at least to the community of women who come to daven. So that's complicated. Okay, let's get into some of the nitty gritties of structure. Okay, and let's start. I warned you that I was going to bring a little piece by Rav Henkin. Okay, this is just a little bit where Rav Henkin makes a very strong argument that he feels that the women's section has to be a physically its own, what's called in halacha, its own reshut, its own halachic domain, distinct from the men's domain. So, for example, Rav Henkin has the position that it's not enough for the mechitza to be something like a vilon, like a curtain. It has to have some kind of unique, domain. Why? Because, and here we go. He says, this is what we always find in the old shuls, that when there is an Ezra's Nashim, it's distinct. By the way, you could question that. We discussed last time a little bit the archaeology and the history of how the shuls were structured. If a shul did have a very small, informal, not structurally distinct mechitza, that's something that could be hard to leave in the archaeological record, let's say. But still, he says, traditionally, the Ezra Nashim is distinct structurally. In most cases, there were separate rooms or upstairs. And it never occurred to anyone to say that having distinct domains was secondary and preventing seeing was primary. So here Rav Henkin makes two claims. Claim number one, there must be separate structural domains for men and women. Claim number two, or it's an assumption underlying that claim, that is going to determine how we're building our mechitza, and that reflects, as reflecting our purpose, where our main purpose is not looking. Our main purpose is preventing mingling. Maramchik takes a completely different perspective. Maramchik is coming from Hungary. The Hungarian mechitzot were not flimsy curtains, to put it mildly. The Hungarian mechitzot were solid. You might call a traditional Hungarian mechitza a wall. Okay, let's see what the Maramchik has to say. Vata, and now, Eza Rishaim. You can already see from the language, wicked people, that he's using that language, that this is a heated issue for him and his community. Ezer Rishaim, some wicked people, Shalhu Yad, have cast their hands, La Ros Be'ezrat Nashim, Davar Mafsik, Be'ezrat Nashim, La'ezrat Anashim. They've gone because they want to destroy the partition between the Ezerot. What does he mean by destruction? Shalo Tehe Sagur Lagamre Be'Krashim, Rakba Amudim, that it wouldn't be completely enclosed with boards, it wouldn't be a totally solid wall, but that there would be pillars, so it might be possible, and this is amazing that to me, that he says it, not just, it's just very striking, and women would be able to see and be seen. V'hine chalila lachem, Lahaksherim, God forbid you, kosher members of my community, lishtok al davar apritzut she'asua chatzufim ahem, to be quiet with this breach that these brazen people have done. Ki medina, because according to the fundamental halacha, anu chayavim la'asot hefsek ben ezrat anashim la'ezrat nashim, we have to make a partition, shelo yir'u anashim l'nashim mipnei shemevi lidei kalut rosh shar averot, that men not see the women, because that can lead to Kalut Rush. So Maram Sheikh is clearly coming from the seeing is the priority perspective. And he's saying that mechitz has got to go all the way up. And it's got to be completely solid. And on the one hand, at the end of the tshuva, he's talking about we need it because we don't want the men to see the women. And yet, as I pointed out earlier, he suggested earlier on that part of his issue would be yuchlu lirot, the women would be able to see and to be seen. It's not hard to imagine why it might have been that there would be members of the community that wanted to modify the mechitza to make it less solid and to allow for sight lines. But if your belief is that the purpose of the mechitza is to prevent sight, then that's going to be a big problem. Okay. Now the Sridei Eish brings in a voice that I think we've been waiting for. And the Sridei Eish brings in the voice of the perspective of how does this really affect the davening, not just of the men, but also of the women. And he's talking and he's referring specifically to the rabbis of Hungary, including Maharam Shik. The rabbis of Hungary, machmirim me'od, they're really stringent. By the way, remember Maharam Shik said it was mi'ikara din, it was the fundamental halacha that it had to be that way. They're very stringent. The doshim shamachitza tiyeh gvoa l'mala mirashar nashim. They insist that the machitza must be above the heads of the women. He means when women are standing, which would mean that if women are sitting, they're certainly just looking at a wall. And when they're standing, they're also looking at a wall. The ode, and further, marchikim lalechet v'dorshim shvi'im ein beit ha'kneset mechitza kazo, asur li palel sham. They go even farther, and they say that if a beit kneset doesn't have a mechitza of that sort, it's prohibited to daven there. V'asur l'nashim lavo li palel umutav shisharu b'vateyem, and it would therefore be prohibited for women to daven there as well. Better they should stay at home. Vaday shekavanatam l'tova, certainly they mean well, lishmor l'tzniut kifi shaitan uga b'dorot akodmim, to preserve tzniut, aval, however, bizmanenu nishtene amatzav v'nishtenu atvayim. He put it straight, times have changed, the situation has changed. V'hanashim, im tishayerna babayit v'lo tavona l'veit ha'kneset, tishtakach mehem torat ha'yaldut megamrei. If you're not going to have women come to shul, if you're going to tell them that the mechitza is modified, they can't go to shul, you're going to lose Judaism. It's over. Bevadai she'asur la'dichan l'argichikan biglal chumra yitera she'en la'yisod mutzak b'shas poskim. And here it comes even stronger because he made a sociological claim and now he's combining it with a halacha claim. He says, that wasn't ikar din. That wasn't the fundamental halacha. He says, this is a chumra yitera. This is an excessive stringency she'en la'yisod mutzak b'shas poskim, with no clear basis in the Gemara and no clear basis in the halachic authorities. And in that case, it's prohibited, he says, to do something that's going to put women off of shul for the sake of a chumrah. Ubizmanenu anashim makpidot me'od im archikim otan mibatei tefillah. And nowadays, women are really particular. They are not happy if you drive them away from tefillah. V'alichal tefillah b'beit ha'kneset hi bizmanenu kiyum yadut l'nashim l'imahot. For many women and mothers, going to shul is an essential part of their Judaism. I mean, of course, we'll have to talk about COVID a little bit and how that might have changed that. But the Sridei Eish is saying, look, when we're thinking about how the mechitza is structured and we're talking about the purposes being not looking or not mingling, however we're going to read that and translate that into architecture, we have to also keep in mind that the purpose of going to shul is davening. And it's not just the men's davening. The reason we have the Ezras Nashim, and remember we saw this when we talked about Simchat Beit HaShoeva, the reason that they built a balcony in Beit HaMikdash, and the reason we have an Ezra Nashim in Shul, is to facilitate men and women being able to daven in the same place and be a part of the community. If that's your purpose, you have to keep that in mind, he says, when you're constructing the Mechitza. Okay. Let's get into some of the nitty-gritty stuff, which is pretty interesting. Those are kind of like the basic elements. But then Rav Moshe has a whole slew of rulings about the mechitza, and it's not surprising that he does. Remember exactly for what we were talking about last time, that this becomes a hallmark of the Orthodox shul. So everyone wants to know kind of, well, what are the boundaries? What's okay, what's not okay? And Rav Moshe comes and he tries to explain. Okay, rule number one. בבתי כנסיות שמתקבצים שם אנשים ונשים להיפלל, טוב יותר לעשות גזוזטרה שנשים יהיו למעלה. He prefers a balcony to being on the same level. Okay? And that makes sense. Again, if his point of departure is that mingling is our big problem, a balcony is going to very successfully curtail mingling in a way that being on the same level can't always. And if that's difficult to do, I mean, it's not always easy to retrofit every space with its own balcony. It has to be a bona fide separation. What is it? A partition. Therefore, therefore, a 10 tefach mechitza is not going to be acceptable. What is he referring to obliquely here, a 10 tefach mechitza? It goes like this. I told you that laws of Erevin come up. Also, the laws of sukkah come up a little bit when talking about mechitza. The word mechitza sometimes is used for the sides of a sukkah. Now, for a wall of a sukkah to be considered kosher, to count as a valid wall, has to be at least 10 tefachim, 10 hand breadths high. It's about 50 inches. There was a ruling in the days when the mechitza was particularly contentious that that was an acceptable minimum for a shul mechitza. That makes some sense, by the way. If we think about it, not with Rav Moshe's approach, but if we think about it according, let's say, to Rav Soloveitchik's approach, who the Frimmer brothers, Rabbis Frimmer, who have written several articles about women in mitzvot, quote, testimony that this was something that Rav Soloveitchik did on occasion or permitted on occasion. Rav Soloveitchik's approach, remember, was that on a Torah level, there needed to be separation between men and women. And only on a rabbinic level, do there have to be a structural partition. So the point at which you're talking about rabbinic law, it's reasonable that you would say the minimum height for our partition within the Beit Knesset would be the same as the minimum height for a partition, say, defining a wall of a sukkah. So that would be the claim. And in fact, Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, Rav Henkin Zatzal's grandfather, went on record poskening that that was acceptable as an absolute minimum. And now Rav Moshe Feinstein comes along and he says it's not enough. He says that is just, it simply does not suffice. Lo sagi, gam b'mechitza shel asarat tefachim. It's about, you know, something like 4 feet, right? It's not enough. Mina karka. She'ena klum le'inyan kalut rosh. She'rei yicholim le'daber ol arbot sichayim anashim v'li shum koshi. A mechitza that you can easily have a conversation over without any trouble is not going to work. If the mechitza is about a little over 4 feet high and the average height of a woman is, let's say, 5'4" or 5'3". I think in the Jewish community, it's probably more like 5'3", right? If the average height of a woman is 5'3", then there's over a foot of clearance for conversations to be going on. That's also a sort of mingling. You know, you can mingle when there's a low partition between you. So he has a problem with that. Aval mistaber laniyat dati shesagi b'mechitza gvoah ad achar ktefayim. So he comes up with another idea, and he says, got to be shoulder height. Why shoulder height? Because at that point, he thinks, and I think he's talking about male shoulder height, though you could argue about it. Later, he says that it's about 60 inches is an absolute minimum, which sounds more like male shoulder height and more like this height on many women. Okay? Where the idea would be that it would be low enough that the sense of people would be that they're in the same space, low enough to allow hearing clearly, low enough to allow perhaps when the Torah is aloft to allow seeing the Torah, but high enough that conversation would not be free. Conversation would be impeded to some extent, and by impeding it, you're impeding mingling and you're achieving a goal of the mechitza. So that's his first ruling, has to do with height. And then he gets into some details of height. For example, like here's the tshuva where he gives kind of, you know, the specific inches where he says that it needs to be at least 5 feet, or here he writes, see, great Hebrew, shishim inches, 60 inches, okay, inches. It's the Yiddish version of the inch. That's what he's saying is the minimum. And there also, he's drawing on other areas of halacha, which also cite this measure. But then he also talks about something that's also a common trick. Well, what if there's like a height differential between the men and women section and the actual wall is above that height differential? Like, let's say there's a step up to, it's like a split level space. There's a step up to the men's section. Does the mechitza still need to be 5 feet above the step up? Or could we count the step up as being part of what we need for height? And he says that the step up could count, but he doesn't like it. Okay, he says, Yesh bateknis yochik biot ritzpat ezrat anashim le'erch fut, F-O-O-T, fut, v'yoter. So there are shuls that have used kind of this height differential to play with the mechitza. And I don't think it's good. I don't think it's good to have a raised women's section, he's saying, and a mechitza of the same height, so that effectively the mechitza is shorter. Ach, mikol makom, eni omer isur barur. But I'm not saying it's prohibited. So this kind of becomes the opinion that gets relied on for shuls that have a height differential between the men's women's section, and the mechitza is still, it effectively feels like it's lower than that 5 feet. Now you should know the Rav Yoel Teitelbaum, obviously, as you might expect, didn't accept any of this. And he really railed at Rav Moshe's rulings. Okay, other interesting points from Moshe about mechitza construction. Lattice work. Well, think about it. We said that Rav Moshe is concerned about mingling first and not about looking. So a lattice work mechitza, according to Rav Moshe, is fine. Why is it fine? Because we're not worried about looking. Again, he's worried about mingling between men and women through the mechitza. And a lattice work, he doesn't think, is going to really make the difference or to facilitate mingling. So again and again, we're seeing the same idea that we had from the beginning, which is that our concept about the purpose of the mechitza is going to translate into rulings about its structure. And you'll notice that Rav Moshe isn't drawing on a lot of poskim to make these points, because again, same problem we had last week. Those poskim aren't out there. We do not have the detailed hilchot how you make a mechitza. So he's really being first and foremost driven by his understanding of its purpose. Another thing that comes up is the question of men looking at women for Rav Moshe. In some of these synagogues, let's say, women might be dressed in a way that's revealing. Does a woman's being dressed in a way that's revealing create a new obligation for mechitza, lest men see this revealing dress in the middle of tefillah? And here, Rav Moshe says, on the whole, this is not his primary concern. Levad inyana mechitza, shezo devar mechuyav, afilu nashim snu biyoter. He says, this is a secondary concern. Aside from the issue of mechitza, which is for everybody, even when women are tsnuot, yesh inyan mechitza bishvil isur istaklut mamash, bimkomot shetzarich shiyu mechusot shem bedin erva bezmanin. He says, look, there could be places where the mechitza is also going to help from this perspective with tznias dress. However, in general, a glass mechitza, which according to him, glass mechitza should be fine, right? Again, if the issue is mingling, why not have something completely see-through from both sides? He's not talking about a one-way mirror. He's talking about a fully see-through, nowadays we do it from plexiglass, right? A fully see-through barrier, saying that would be fine. But it's moila l'din mechitza, eina moila l'isur kriyat shema tefila neged erva. If the women are really undressed, it won't help. So he comes up with a compromise idea. Im beit haknesset she'en menichim l'nashim megulot hazro'ot v'chadome l'ikanes, v'sheim midina l'asot af mechitza mizchuchit. Fundamentally, a mechitza where women are usually dressed, there you can do the whole mechitza from glass. In other places, and this is something that I guess it's not necessarily his compromise, but it's the compromise people came up with, the bottom of the mechitza might be solid, but the top of the mechitza might be glass. And the idea there is that what's going to be revealed by the top of the mechitza being glass is not going to raise issues of men seeing things that are not covered, that halachically they shouldn't be seeing when they're davening. But it also still enables, what needs to be covered, as it will, the mechitza will help cover, and it will enable sight lines for the women to see within the shul. And that makes sense. Again, for Moshe, if the primary issue is not mingling, and a secondary possible fringe benefit of the mechitza is helping with tznias issues, then that's not our main concern. A see-through mechitza should be great. To the extent that we are concerned, the whole thing doesn't have to be solid. And that's what we see in a lot of shuls. They'll have a solid bottom and the top will be a curtain, right? And the top will be a glass. And that's what that's about. They want to get that kind of fringe benefit from the mechitza in the case that there might be a tznias issue, and that would be a problem for men to see while they're davening. But they also want to facilitate as much as possible that women should see the tefillot, which is possible because the din of mechitza itself, the law of mechitza itself, is primarily understood along the lines of Rav Moshe, which is that it's an issue of mingling, not looking. Okay, we have, we're running out of time. I want to do a drop more with you. What I wanted to do was to show you, let's do this tshuva, and I want to show you a tshuva by Rav Schachter for now. Rabbi Jay, I think I might want to do a little more in Mechitza next week, if that's okay, even though we said 2 weeks.
I already told you, we advertised a 13-week course, but as we discussed, we're going to extend the course when we're finished.
Yay! Thank you. And because I think what I'd also like to address is mechitza and settings outside of the shul, which is another world of discussion. So here's the question that Ramosh has asked. Sha'altim tzarich mechitza kshemit palalim b'makom she'eno kavua l'tfila. This is something that comes up a lot with COVID and outdoor minions. Do you need a mechitza in a place that's not always reserved for tfila? L'mashal, bevet avil, rachmanu litzman. For example, in a shiva house. Im tzrichot anashim elech l'cheder nifrad, o shadai behafsek avir. Do women have to go to a different room in a shiva house during the minyan? By the way, this is something that actually happened. You might be surprised how often this question comes up. There are a lot of women who are not comfortable davening in the same room as men. Suddenly they're in a shiva house. It might be their own home. They might be the ones sitting shiva, for whom on some level the minyan is being convened. And that's very complicated, the dynamic of figuring out where it's appropriate to be or not to be. V'nira, and it seems, he says, Shalidina anashim bevet aval tzrichot lalechet lecheder acher. He thinks women should really go to another room. V'atam debet aval avim akom shepatuch l'rabim, because he thinks of a velut or a shiva as a fundamentally public enterprise. You know, at a wedding, if someone wants to show up at a wedding, they need an invitation. You don't need an invitation to come to a shiva. There's a way in which a shiva is more of a public mass event than a wedding. Aval, im lemasa anashim enan maskimot lazov et acheder nechshav ze lakray. If in practice it's not comfortable, the women don't want to leave the room, it's considered to be an occasional thing, not a set thing. Ve'im limana me'alet palel machmat ze. And you don't have to stop davening for that reason. So again, in a place that's fixed, set up, prepare, what we call in halacha kavua, Ramosha says, you need a mechitza anytime that place is kavua, even if it's not technically a shul. But in a place where there's a one-off tefillah, an occasional tefillah, there's a preference. If it's comfortable for the women to go to another room, from his perspective, great. But it's not 100% obligatory. There's room not to do that. But if you go to it, you're talking about a sheva brachas, you're talking about a wedding, don't need. Here he makes the distinction. A wedding he sees as being more private. Again, you don't go to the wedding without the invitation. And because it's not fundamentally or inherently, from his perspective, a public or shall we say communal space, if it's not fundamentally a communal space and it's not a space that's fixed or set on a regular basis for prayer, then you don't need a mechitza. Men should just go into a corner. Nice that he says the men should take the initiative and find their spot. Okay. He continues and he says, Im tzarich mechitza lachtzotz rak bifnei isha achat o shtayim. Do you need a mechitza if there's just one or two women that show up in a space? I think Rabbi Jay mentioned this tshuva last class. In all the generations, you'd have occasionally a poor woman, an impoverished woman coming into shul for tzedakah, or a velal or a woman in mourning to say Kaddish. Says, look, it requires further investigation, but you can permit it on occasion. Now, back to Rav Yehuda Henkin. Rav Henkin's tshuva, which addresses this topic, cites as an example or as precedent, Beit HaMikdash. We talked about how in Beit HaMikdash, there was basically a distinction. Women weren't usually in the Azara. But on occasion, there would be a reason. Let's say she was a Nazira. She had made a vow of being a Nazirite, and she was bringing her korban for the end of her period of being a Nazirite. She has to bring her korban. In that case, there's a place for her to go within the Azara. It's not a usual thing. It's an occasional thing. So too here. But he says in this case, rakat bet nashim lo yoter. Maximum in that kind of scenario of coming into the men's section and davening, keeping going undisturbed, two women maximum, and on an occasional basis, not on a regular basis. Last part of this question, that's a repetition of what I just said. There's one last thing I want to look at with you before we call it a night. And that, I put it here on the bottom. And that is a tshuva that just came out by Rav Herschel Schachter about outdoor minyanim with COVID. Okay, we have it right here. This was put out by YU. Anyone who wants to go on to YU Torah, if you do a search on COVID tshuvot, there's a whole slew of really interesting responses that Rav Schachter has written. The responses tend to be pretty brief and to the point. So they're readable. They're also usually English translations. Here we go. Razal hevinu v'haya machanecha kodesh, and your kadosh, and your camp should be holy or sacred. Chazal hevinu mipasuk zeh. Rabbis understood from this verse, debachol pam sheyesh imanu shchina, beinan kedushat hamachane mitzad ervat zor zoem meraglayim. That whenever we're supposed to have a situation of our camp being holy, trying to make this bigger for you, then we should, that should be reflected by being careful about uncovered nakedness or excrement or urine. That God, the Lord your God, walks within your camp to save you. And it's also the case during davening and learning Torah, the Shekhinah is there. There's discussion about what's considered a machane. The Chazon Ish, that whenever there are 10, whenever there's a minyan, the Shekhinah is there. Whenever there's a minyan, the Shekhinah is present. Okay, what's his point? The Shekhinah is present, he says. There's a minyan there. We have to be careful about nakedness, uncovering nakedness. The Ein Sham B'Yalkut Shimonu, look in the Yalkut Shimoni, which says, L'fichach, ki teitzei, dechalul b'din kedushat ha-machaneh mutfila, shelo yiyu nashim u'gvarim b'tarovet. We learn from this, from Yalkut Shimoni and ki teitzei, that it's better for men and women not to be mixed in prayer. Ela b'inan archakat, this is very interesting, rather, they need a distance of dalet amot elu me'elu. Okay? And there should be a distance between the men and women. Here he's putting a number on it, of dalet amot. What are dalet amot and why should that be relevant? Well, an amah in English is a cubit, or let's say the length of your forearm from the middle to the elbow, okay, would be roughly the amah. Four amot in rabbinic literature represent kind of the personal space, the personal zone. And such that, for example, if I come within four amot of an object, I might be able to acquire it by dint of my proximity to it. There's a law when it comes to tefillah, that if a person is davening, we're not supposed to walk in front of them when we're davening. We're not supposed to walk in front of them either because it might break their concentration or because it might disrupt the connection between them and God's presence. And the halacha is, it's okay to walk in front of them if it's four amot away from the person. Okay, now we're getting to the heart of what he wants to say. D'shiur zeh shel dalet amot nomad. No, you know what, I'm going to skip a little bit. Okay, here we go. So shezem mikomo shel mitpalel. The dalet amot is the place of the person who's praying. And from there, one could infer that a man, even a man praying alone in his home, should not pray within four amot of his wife or his daughter or his sister or his mother. Because we think that that has a precedent from Chana, from the biblical Chana, and from Eli. And now he gets to the halachic point. When we start arranging now with COVID, minyanim, outside of the home, and it's nice that he points that out, women presumably will also want to participate. We still have to be careful about this. And as shul, we say the separation isn't enough. That's what we saw repeatedly last week. We need actually a partition or a separate domain. Okay, so then he continues into the Shabbos. And finally, he says, after me ikar adin, kashela tzrich mechitza, sheyatchilu litasef li palal b'tzibur b'chutz. Even though fundamentally, according to the law, it's hard to say that they would be obligated to have mechitza when they just gather outdoors, at least in the beginning when they establish the minyan. In any case, it still must not look like we're imitating the goyim he throws in. And therefore, it's appropriate, even at a wedding or a sheva bracha, the men and women be separate by four amot. What's he saying, bottom line? He's saying like this. You're making an outdoor minyan. I'd love for you to have a mechitza. It's not feasible for whatever reason. You still need to be separate. You're davening inside. You're on lockdown like we are here in Israel, or you have a curfew. You're davening in your home with your family. You don't have to have mechitza up. You need to have distance. What's that distance, he says? It's four amot, four cubits, which is not a minor distance. It gets pretty close to about 6 feet. So it's something like 2 meters, around 6 feet. So it's a substantial distance. And then he adds something interesting. You know, Rav Moshe, when he talked about a wedding as being a place where you don't need a mechitza, Rav Moshe said, well, the men can just daven in the corner. And what Rav Schachter says is, well, that's not what concerns me. What concerns me is that there are four amot between the men and the women. Sometimes this might complicate things, but sometimes it actually might simplify them. In particular, for women who have ever wondered if it's appropriate for them to daven in certain situations where there isn't a clear separate space for men and for women, this ruling, knowing that in that kind of a situation, a four amot distance, about 6 feet of distance, suffices, can actually be helpful in kind of a rule of thumb of figuring out where to situate yourself. In other words, you don't have to hide behind the potted plant unless you want to hide behind the potted plant, but you don't have to hide behind the potted plant. You can just make sure that there is about 6 feet of distance, 2 meters of distance between you and the men in the minyan. And if you do that, you're okay. And men the same way. You don't have to start chasing the women out of the room if it's a one-off thing, even in a house of mourning, which is the case that Rav Moshe mentioned, where he thinks it's preferable that the women go to a different room, because in a house of mourning, it's a communal occasion where the entire community is welcome. And therefore, he thinks it's really obligatory that there be a mechitza. Even there, if for a reason, for whatever reason, that's not going to go over, Moshe says that on an occasional basis, it's okay for the davening to be with the men and the women in the same room, as long as there's space. Okay, let's take some questions.
Okay, I guess that means I'm on call. I'll save my story for next week because it's late, but okay. Okay, the woman section, Hey Chosh Shlomo, yeah, listen, I can tell you the one time how you started your shiur when I was in the Gris Kolel, and the first week that the Michlala came, so they asked the guys in the kollel to come make a minyan Friday night. Rabbi Cooperman, you know, spoke to all the girls. So we had exactly 10 guys from the Gris Kollel, and we were in a little corner, curtained off totally. We were leaning down, and then all the women were there, you know, were there. But it was interesting, that experience. You know, I was young and whatever. But yes, I think it's very important that men sit in a woman's section before, you know, that is a very good idea. Anyways, okay, so about that, there are mechitzah that both separate and prevent seeing. Of course, I just recommend go down in the shul where you can't see.
Okay. First of all, there are people who prefer that, right? I mean, one of the things that we didn't even start to talk about is how much difference there can be with personal preference in terms of mechitza. But one of the things that is interesting, so there are shuls where it's both, and they're trying to discharge all possible opinions, right? Maximum position compliance right there in the mechitza structure. And for some women that work and men, that works very well, and not for everybody always. Okay.
I mean, you didn't address, maybe you can touch on next week, the shuls. There, I know of at least one in Toronto, a major shul that has a mechitza. You cannot tell what's the men or the women's section when you walk into shul. The mechitza splits the shul exactly in half, including the bima. As you know, I don't know if you've seen some of the mechitza. That's an interesting new style of mechitza. I don't think ever existed till the modern world, like the last, 10 years. Okay, let's see what else. There are shuls. Okay, the Sridei Eish, was he discussing woman not having a place in shul, or they're feeling unwelcome shul? I think, you know, both, if you want to.
Yeah, it's pretty clear to me that he was talking about both. Yeah. He was, on the one hand, he was objecting to the idea that you tell women to stay home from shul based on the mechitza not meeting what he considered to be a chumrah, a stringency. And also was concerned that this is ultimately going to distance women from Yiddishkeit.
It's why if we ever have a shir on bat mitzvah, the Sridei Eish has a famous comment, and it's in his responsa that you have to give your daughters the exact same level as, you know, party and celebration as you do for the boys for the bar mitzvah. It's discrimination, and that's the words is haflaya, to give the boys a big party and the girls, you know, bar mitzvah. So that's also a true mitzvah issue. You see, he clearly is addressing the general issue, not just the mechitza issue. That was already answered. The Sridei Eish, right, 1884, 1966. Mark Shapiro, of course, is the world's expert on the Sridei Eish. His PhD is giving class, I mean, not on the Sridei Eish, but every Monday night, I just figured I'd throw that in. The Sridei Eish didn't have Jewish day schools, so the shul was their lifeline. It's an interesting comment by Chaim.
I don't know that.
That's true. In Germany, they had day schools already long before the Sridei Eish.
I'll tell you, I was recently last year, right before the pandemic hit, I was in Britain, and I was talking to some women there, and the way they described their shul experience was the challenges some of them experienced with shul was saying this is our lifeline to Judaism. That experience, I don't think, is as limited as we might like it to be.
Although they did for sure in Germany, where he spent the sort of middle part of his life, when he was the head of the Hildesheim Seminary, of course, day schools were well established. And I know the Hirsch in school, I mean, he was in Berlin, but the Hirschian school in Frankfurt, of course, had the boys and girls in one building. There were separate classes. I know people who attended the school, you know, after he passed away, they had separate classes, but the boys and girls in Shimshon Fel Hirsch school were all in one building. So that's an interesting thing. Of course, the Sridei Eish also has a famous tshuva, before tshuva earlier, on Koalisha, men and women singing together, which he permits, of course, like NCSY, Bnei Akiva, those type of, or Yeshurun was the youth group he was talking about, but that asked him the question. Anyways, right.
What's also interesting there, I'll just point in. So it's not just the timing is the time frame is not the only interesting thing there. The location, the geographic location, is interesting as well. Meaning the fact it's not a coincidence that the Sridei Eish is responding to a rav from Hungary, because the conventions of what women were used to or comfortable with was going to vary from place to place, and the level of stringency was going to vary from place to place.
100%. There's more to discuss. We'll leave that for another time. Ellen starts pointing out that right through in Hilchot Eiruvin, if the woman is in a separate section, I will tell you, Rav Schechter, since you quoted him, Rav Schechter told us, I remember telling us more than once, that his father, Rav Melech Schechter, was also a big Rav, not as famous, but that in his town in Romania, they would have a young girl or a woman was saying Kaddish. There weren't any brothers. So first of all, they had the woman saying Kaddish. They would insist the woman come into the men's section to make sure she's part of the minyan. If she's sitting in the balcony, it's not 100% sure she's part of the minyan. So in Romania, the shul, there was no issue of woman. You know, that was just what they did in order to ensure that the amen, she's part of the minyan. So that's
I'm going to want to look at that next time, actually. Let's next time, okay. Blineder, let's kick off by just looking at the status of the woman's section in terms of its sanctity and in terms of participating in Tefillah B'Tzibur. Okay, we'll start with that before we move to out of shul.
Very good. Sorry. Okay. Why are women with children so always given so little space at the Kotel? I don't think either of us can answer that question.
Well, I mean, it gets into what you were saying with the side by side, and this is where things are difficult, right? So, what chicken and egg? Does the attractive women's section draw more women to daven, or should we not allocate more precious shul space than we have to women who don't come? These questions aren't hard when questions, generally speaking, aren't so hard when there's unlimited resources, right? If you've got a huge amount of space, you don't have a problem allocating a very big amount of space to everybody who might be interested. Where things get tricky is where you have limited resources. I think one of the places where you've seen this really come to a head is with the COVID stuff, right? So let's say you have a minion, and I have actually a friend like this, who is a gabbai of a minion, and he's generally speaking very particular to always make sure that there's a women's section during the minion, and that men not enter that space. But then the pandemic hits, and there are all kinds of regulations about how many men can fit in the space. And in fact, even though he's so sure about making sure there's room for women, he knows that it's basically something like once every 1.5 weeks for one of the minyanim, a woman will come. And every day there's usually men who are packed into the regular space. So that, you know, these things become really difficult. You have a large group of women who come to shul on a regular basis. A large subset of those women come to shul late. And there could be very good reasons for coming to shul late. They might be involved with young children who aren't always so easy to get out of the house. They might be caretaking in some other way, shape, or form. There might be other reasons why they're coming to shul late. Would making a bigger women's section encourage them to come to shul early? Or is it causing in some cases where, let's say, a shul is really small, is it causing in some places unnecessary kind of difficulty for the men who are there from the beginning every time? These questions actually aren't as easy to answer as we'd like them to be. There is a little bit of a chicken and an egg element to it. And I guess one of the things we talked about a little bit last time is that on the whole, men do tend to feel more ownership of the shul space than women do. And that brings all kinds of things. You know what, actually, I'm going to quickly, and we really should end, but I want to show you one more thing that I put on the source sheet that's just fascinating. So if you bear with me, I'm going to share screen one more time and just get a load of this. I hope this works. Let's try. Yes. Okay. Let's see if I can get, this was the tshuva that we just looked at. And right above it, this is a sign that comes from a shul in Tinek. I had to snap a shot of this, or someone who works with me snapped a shot of this because we found it so fascinating. This is a sign from the women's section. Please note that this is an Ezra's Nashim, a location that is reserved for women. Please do not occupy this area at any point during davening, any daytime of the week, even if no women are seen present. If you are occupying this area, you are preventing women from being able to enter the Ezra's Nashim. Thank you for your consideration. Why preventing women in this particular shul? The issue is that some of the Sfarim are kept in the Ezra's Nashim. This is Beit Midrash space, and the Sfarim are near the entrance. So what was happening, men were routinely going in to get Sfarim during, before, in the middle, after of Tefillah, and women were not feeling comfortable going into the Ezra's Nashim because the men are standing there toward the entrance holding a sefer. So the rabbi actually had a plaque made to try to encourage men to keep the space open for women. And he was willing to do this even though, and this is what's so interesting, even if no women are seen present, because it's that sense of And I've had this happen. I had a morning, you know, actually I had a woman call me a few months ago, and in my shul, I like to think of as a very welcoming shul to women. She was a mourner, and she called me because she wanted to start going to Minyan at the shul. And the door to the Ezra Sanashim was locked repeatedly when she wanted to go. And she really wanted to go. No one knew there was someone who wanted to go. But maybe you only find out that there's someone who wants to go if she's there. Maybe she can only be there if the door is unlocked. So there are a lot of also surrounding issues around this that are not just about the halachot of mingling, but are about a lot of deeper dynamics. So we should probably stop here. Rabbi Jay, is there anything else you'd like
That's
to say?
Fine. No, we can pick up next week. No, just point out the 6 weeks and the separation. Anyways, six, four on what is perfect separation of the men for COVID also has been pointed out.
That is a good point. Yes.
Yeah, so anyways, the men have to stay more that apart. Okay.